Well, this hour we'll continue talking about the tragedy in Connecticut. Dr. Peter Bragan, psychiatrist, will be with us. We'll talk about the mind of a killer in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Peter Bragan, of course, private practice psychiatrist, world leader in psychiatric reform. He has been on our program numerous times. I turn to him when we need these kinds of issues answered by someone in a very concise, professional way, and nobody does it better than Peter Bragan. Peter, before we get into the mind of a killer, I think it's only appropriate to get your thoughts and comments on today's tragedy.
George, thank you for having me on and for letting me participate. This is such a national tragedy. The loss of a child to trauma, to violence, to accident even, is probably the most devastating experience in a human being's life. I actually was at a conference only a few months ago of several hundred people who were parents who had lost their children to trauma, to violence, to accidents mostly, and they didn't even speak of recovering. They didn't even talk about, oh, we'll get over this. They spoke of comfort, mm-hmm. They spoke of the importance of love, learning to integrate this experience into their lives, but not of just recovering. And they often resented the psychiatrists, my colleagues, who diagnosed them with depression because they didn't get over this bereavement in a few months or years. And they often felt that getting the psychiatric drugs was suppressing their feelings and was not providing them the love and support they needed. So I want to just take a moment and say, you know, that our hearts go out to these parents in particular,
yeah,
who have lost a child.
The grief will be unbelievable, Peter.
Yeah.
How do you, as a parent, you know, I've got three kids. I've got six grandchildren. My biggest fear, and I only have really one, is that any of them goes before I do. That is the worst thing for a parent to go through. What would you do? How would you counsel someone whose child was killed today?
Well, I think you approach it with no arrogance and no know-it-allness to counsel someone who's had that kind of bereavement. You approach it with awe and respect, and you do your best to keep some company, you know, to be there, to listen, to not even make many suggestions, not at the start at least, but to keep them company, to let them know you're there. And eventually, you know, what people have to do is to revive their ability to love. And you do that not by suppressing the loss, but by knowing the loss and knowing the grief and then daring to continue to reach out with love. And if you can encourage a person in that manner, and often that can be done by a minister, rabbi, a priest, by friends, encourage the person to be there with you, that's a beginning in that process. But this has got to be done very respectfully and with just the enormous sensitivity to the size of this kind of loss.
All right, let's talk about the mind of a killer, Peter. What we saw this week in Portland, Oregon, in a mall, killer kills two, kills himself. In this particular case, 26 people killed at the school. He kills himself, 27, kills his mother in her home, 28. Then what is going on mindset, first of all? And we'll get into specifics with this individual, with whatever we may or may not know. But what causes someone to kill, and then they kill themselves?
Well, let's look at some really common things that all of the worst killers have, that we have had in these situations, what they have in common. If you look at what we know so far about Adam Lanza, he's a very bright loner with no social connections.
No trouble, really, right? No trouble.
No trouble, but very geeky, not relating to people, behaving oddly, being nervous. He almost doesn't exist for the students who saw him,
mm-hmm.
And he doesn't even show up for his class photograph. So he, in this way, he's a lot like The Aurora shooter that we talked about so much.
The guy who thought he was the Joker?
Yep. Again, a loner, a weird guy, very, very, very bright. And it's also very similar to the Columbine shooters. And, again, very, very loners, although they had each other.
And all young, Peter.
All young, and all young men. But there's another thing about them which people really need to know. All of them got involved with psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not a matter of, hey, we got to identify these kids and get them the shrinks. My colleagues are going to help them. We can do them a lot of good. And it's all of these boys ended up in the system. We don't know about, Dylan Klebold. But, his colleague was certainly on psychiatric drugs.
Well, and this kid, his brother, when his brother was being questioned, said he's mentally disabled.
That's right.
That's what he said.
And there's discussion that he's in the Post, the Washington Post, and other places, he's on medication. When you have a wealthy family like this with a boy who's identified as disabled, you can be sure he was on meds. And people were describing him as being flat in his emotions and jittery. And boy, that's what you see in a lot of people who are going over the edge on psychiatric drugs. So I think we're seeing this combination now where you have these boys who can't relate. They feel impotent and powerless. They're shame-driven. All of them are morbidly shy people. They have grievances. We don't know about this young man's grievances. Certainly in almost every case we've looked in, they feel they've been humiliated. They have grievances. And when they get into psychiatry, it ends up doing more harm than good. Eric Harris, the Columbine shooter, had a blood level of Zoloft on autopsy. We know it, despite what the press keeps telling us. I've seen the data. I was an expert in some of his cases. So I think we got to find another way other than our conventional psychiatry to start reaching out to young men in school who are obviously not connecting, not being brought in, not being made a part of the society, and we can't do it by diagnosing them and drugging them. We got to find more caring, outreaching ways. This boy, at the age of 4 or 5, people knew he was behaving differently. And, George, in my experience, if you start to work with a young boy like this and his family at the age of 5, 6, 7, or 8, you can see a huge turnaround.
Sure. You would hope so. But let me ask you this, Peter. As a psychiatrist, if you had a patient, and, of course, you've got the doctor-patient responsibility, but if you had a patient and you believed as the doctor, this guy seriously could kill someone or a number of people, would you report that to law enforcement? What do you do with that?
Well, there is a duty to warn in just about every state. I mean, it's in the law. If a psychiatrist and often other health professionals, a wide variety of health professionals, but particularly psychiatrists, believe that somebody is about to harm an identifiable human being or do an identifiable kind of crime, you have an obligation to report legally, and I think you do morally, too. And if I tell patients this, too, I mean, if it becomes meaningful, and it leads to important discussions about what they're doing and getting themselves under control. But in I have never had a patient commit violence. I did once call. I once told a man who I thought was going to go beat up his wife when he went home that I wanted to call his wife, that this was just, out of control. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was dangerous. So I called her, and she cursed me out and told me to mind my own business. That is the only time that I have felt that that's what I had to do. And I think one of the things is, since I don't use psychiatric drugs to treat people who are very upset and very angry and very disturbed, I think it's one of the reasons why I've never had an actual serious violence or a suicide in my practice. I think it's just partly it's good luck, partly it's the people who come to me, partly it's the angels watching over me. But it's also that I'm not giving them these humiliating diagnoses, starting them on a psychiatric career, and I'm not drugging them, because drugs crush empathy. We got these talking heads on CNN and on Fox, and they're talking about how he's a psychopath, he doesn't have empathy, none of which we have any indication for. And they don't tell you that if you're worried about destroying empathy, don't give psychoactive drugs to people.
Peter, what about the copycats? I mean, I'm sure this kid today witnessed the Portland mall shooting of a few days ago. Now, I'm also sure he has probably been planning this a little longer than that episode, which occurred several days ago. What about the copycat possibilities? I mean, is somebody else out there now who's going to say, well, he did it, so am I?
Copycat is huge. And I think that's playing a role in all of these situations that have evolved over the past decade. Young men who are identifying with these other withdrawn, geeky guys. They're identifying with the loners, and they're seeing what they have done. And I'm sure copycatting plays a role. And that means that we got to be especially vigilant in the next few months. Another thing, George, and I'd be interested in your opinion on this. I think these games are preparing these kids, they're practicing them at violence.
I've said that before.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a big part of this, too. I mean...
I'll tell you one thing it does, is it helps them in terms of their aiming and dexterity. I mean, these games, video games, for example, Peter, where you're shooting, these guns and things into the screen, I think they make these kids great marksmen.
I'm sure. I mean, first of all, those same simulations are used to fly airplanes and learn combat in the military. So,
yes.
I mean, they work. And they also inure people to harming others. You get used to it. I mean, the past few weeks, the TV has been filled with ads for these violent games.
It's Christmas time. They want to sell as many as they can. There's huge business out there.
Cannot be helpful.
Can we ban them? Or, you know what? I haven't bought a video game in God knows how long. I don't even know if they have, like the movies, a parental guidance thing on it. Are they rated?
Well, I don't know a lot about that, George. And, I'm not big on banning things. I think we start to need to apply moral conscience, boycott, other economic pressures to people who make movies and video games that are filled with violence. The public has to speak to them would be my preferred way, by saying, no, we're not going to put these in our homes. We're not going to let our kids buy them. We're not going to go see violent movies and take our children to violent movies. The culture of violence, seeing violence perpetrated in such real-life manners and then actively perpetrating it in these interactive ways, it's got to be terrible for.
What do you do psychiatrically with the children who survived this episode today?
Well, we begin with common sense. And the common sense is that the single most important thing for your child's sense of security is you as a parent. So if these issues do come up, you want to be very zen as a parent.
I mean, if a car backfires, the kid's going to go crazy.
Well, it could if he's seen this stuff. So you want to talk to your kids enough to find out if they know anything about this. And you can be sure if they're watching television, they know something.
I'm sure the school district will bring in counselors and psychiatrists to work with these kids.
Well, you're talking now about the survivors.
The survivors.
At school.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They need to be talked with. But most of all, they need to get closer to their families. At a time like this, the surviving kids the parents need to know that they are the answer. The counselors are not the answer. The counselors can get a little something good started. I'd rather see the counselors working with the whole families, because the family, the parents, the brothers and sisters are going to be the ones that help heal. They're the core. Psychiatry forgets this all the time and goes and counsels a kid and drugs a kid. But what we really need in these situations is to strengthen the loving, secure bonds within the surviving children's families.
When would you open up the school again? I mean, we're going into Christmas soon. We got New Year's. Obviously, they're going to be closed and shut down beyond that, but when do you think realistically you can open the schools again so the kids can feel comfortable?
Well, you know, God, you're asking such good questions, and I don't know that there's anybody with good answers, but I certainly would think after, at the least, not until the new semester.
Yeah, and definitely they're going to have to clean up that school. My God.
Yeah, I mean, I
can't have any.
I would think
that
never would be one of my thoughts. I mean, I think something better can be done with that school now. Would be my thought.
Well, but they got to do something with the kids, Peter. You know, the survivors. You know, school continues. Life moves on. As sad as it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have an easy answer for that one. I think it's very important you're raising it, and the community needs to be thinking about it, whether that school can ever be a sanctuary again. Because it's not a huge school. It was, the first few grades, up to fourth?
It was a little school. It was an elementary school.
Yeah, and it didn't even go to fifth grade, I don't think. So, you know, it's a small school. I certainly wouldn't be rushing anybody back into that school again, and maybe wait and see what wise people in that community feel and what alternatives they have. And it's going to be a community decision the more I think about it.
Same with the teachers, too.
Yeah. Everybody's got to be involved in making that decision.
It's a shame nobody was able to jump this kid.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Well, you know, he went after real little ones.
How long does somebody plan something like that? And do they plan to kill themselves?
Well, usually these are longer-term planning. They're usually planning to kill themselves. And sometimes they back out of cowardice or fear or whatever. They don't want to face the consequences. These are, you know, if there's one essence to these things, from whatever direction they're coming from, it's I'm going to have the power. I'm going to be the deal. I'm going to run the game. Hey, I'm going to be the shooter. It's I'm not going to be shamed and belittled. I'm going to be powerful. But then they don't want to be public martyrs in dealing with these issues.
Peter, let me ask you about the family. The family of the shooter. Do they see any signs that would tell them this kid has the potential to kill others or himself?
Usually there's a lot of spillage. Usually it's all over the place. And then people realize it in retrospect. We don't have any data on this. And since those guns were in the house, maybe there wasn't a lot of planning. Maybe his mother was, one reference to her being a gun collector.
I mean, could he have seen the Portland, Oregon mall shooting of this week and it triggered him to do this?
I think especially if he's on psychiatric drugs, he could have been triggered in an hour to do something like this, just depending on how much planning was actually involved in it, which is hard to tell at this point. There's statements that he had a flak, you know, jacket on and stuff, the bulletproof vest, but we don't know for sure. But I can tell you with many, many cases, Jordan, I've had a lot of violence cases that I've looked at for court and I've looked at as a consultant. And a lot of violence is on drugs is very abrupt because the drugs, just the psychiatric drugs, many of them, especially antidepressants, benzodiazepines, and stimulants, which is a lot of the drugs, they give a sudden disinhibition. A man who's never harmed a woman in his life gets an increase in his dose of an antidepressant and commits a horrendous, horrible rape.
Peter, when we come back, I want to talk with you again on why so many people are being whacked out these days. I mean, they're acting strange. Plus, we'll take phone calls with you. Dr. Peter Bragan with us, his website also linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Well, next hour on Coast to Coast AM, we will have open lines for you. Kind of a downer day today, no doubt, but we will have open lines. And we'll come back in a moment with Peter Bragan, and we'll take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we're with Dr. Peter Bragan this hour. We'll take your calls. Peter, people are still acting strange, whacked out. We've had you on talking about that before. They're not getting any better. Why are they so uptight?
Well, there's a lot of changes going on in the society. You're becoming a less moral society in general. We're becoming a less cohesive society, a society that has less emphasis on certain basic values. We're becoming a society where family life is, is continuing to weaken. Now we've got economic strains in the society. I think we're becoming a more conflicted society. I think things are getting worse in a lot of ways. And, you know, I remember when I was back in elementary school, our principal once a week would read from the Old Testament. It was mostly a Christian community. I was Jewish. I don't think he read from the New Testament, but I remember sitting there as a child thinking, I am being read something important, even if I didn't understand it, and it had to do with a moral life, and that there was some meaning to this life. And if we think we've stripped that out of our education entirely, the idea that life is about taking charge and being responsible and being moral and contributing to the society, we're coming apart in a lot of ways.
Well, we really are, and people are so uptight about it, even during the holiday season. And let me ask you that, Peter, then we'll take calls. They're lining up for you. The holiday season, one of the reasons why we broadcast live on holidays and not on tape is because I think people get lonely, those without families, and they need something. So this show, I think, is part of that for them.
I think that's great.
But it's a rough time for people, isn't it, the holiday season?
Yes, it is. It's a rough time because people are alone. That's another thing about our societal stress. There's an awful lot of Americans live alone. The number keeps growing. And so it can be very lonely at the holidays. Also, a lot of people are going to visit with families where they have a lot of painful memories, and they don't know how to handle that. And often childhood memories come up that are very traumatic at the holidays. So there's a lot of things that can make the holidays not so good for people. Again, you know, I think one of the big keys is if you are lonely, well, then go out and relate to some folks, because there's a lot you can do at the holidays to help people. You can work at a soup kitchen. You can go to church. You can join a choir. You can find a way to relate. And if you've been having those family problems every year where you go and you get abused on a visit back to what used to be called home, maybe it's time to reconsider that.
Yeah,
time
maybe.
To reconsider whether it's good for you and your wife and yourself and your husband and your kids.
Let's go to the phones now. Mary, Salt Lake City, west of the Rockies. You're on with Peter Bragan. Mary, go ahead.
Hi. I hope this doesn't sound too much off the wall, but you were talking about games. And I was wondering if some of these kids could be hypnotized by some of these games, and whether the government might have something to do with this, where they take vulnerable children that they know have problems and either put it on subliminally or something else and trigger.
It was one of the theories of one of my callers last hour, Peter, that maybe these are like Manchurian candidates, these killers, that they've been mind warped or something.
Well, it would be hard for me to see what advantage that would give anybody in power. I think it's more, I do agree, though, with the idea that these things can be spellbinding. I think getting deeply enmeshed in violent games is going to do something to your mind and your brain. I just have no doubt about that it can not only train you, but give you the ideas, develop your strategies, wipe out your empathy for killing people, or at least impair it. I have no doubts about that. I would say that the cause here is more, though I do believe in a relatively free economy, that it's corporate greed, violence sells. I think that's probably much more what's going on.
All right, thanks, Mary. Next up, we go to Dennis in Terre Haute, Indiana, wildcard line. Dennis, thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question, and I was wondering why men in general have such a propensity towards these kind of acts, and you know, you never hear of women doing this kind of stuff. I mean, I know women are capable of being mean, but this, why is it always men? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's primarily men, isn't it?
It's primarily men, but don't underestimate the amount of violence that women do. I've been involved in legal cases where women have killed their children, for example.
Yeah.
So we don't want to minimize that, and we've had some pretty horrible women when situations were permitted for them to behave.
Is that called Munchausen's, by the way, where they hurt their kids or something?
Well, there are women, yes, and it's usually women, almost always women, where they actually make their children sick because they benefit somehow from all the attention they get on the hospital wards from the doctors and nurses who think they are the most caring and involved parents in the world. And that's called Munchausen's by proxy, because you're not the one going in sick or making yourself sick. You're making usually your young child sick, Munchausen's by proxy. So there's all ways of violence. But yes, it is men who commit this mass violence. You know, there is such a thing as evolution, and we did evolve in different directions. And violent societies survive. And violent species survive, and this is a part of evolution. It's a part of human nature. It's got to be tamed. It takes a lot of society, a lot of culture, a lot of religion, a lot of morality to contain this. Our founders knew that. Our founders were so well aware that human nature had a tendency toward violence. I just think this is a very real part of life, that men in particular, of course, that we have the testosterone that does affect us, but more importantly, we have the acculturalization and we have the physique for the violence. So, yeah, men do it, but this is a part of the evolution of our species, and progress is about culture and society making us all feel like we are one group rather than a bunch of me and you, and I hate you, and you don't matter, and you don't count, and you're different. So I think we just more and more have to see ourselves one big tribe, because we are tribal, and we do get violent toward other people.
Kay is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on the wild card line. Kay, go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. I wanted to make a comment. I have a child that does play video games. He's 16 years old, very smart, very athletic, very social. And he's very good. He's one of the top in the country at playing one of the war games. It's very popular. But I wanted to say that I can't really see why people, or especially the guest, made a comment that video games make people go kill people, whereas my son and all his friends, it actually makes them more problem solvers, whereas they can think a problem and solve it before most people can. And so that kind of makes me feel a little upset, because you can't say that gangs kill people. You can't say that guns kill people without people operating the guns. Or you can't say that comment without saying like spoons make people fat. You can't compare those all together.
Well, I see where you're coming from, Peter. When I was a kid, I had a cap gun. I used to run around with a holster and a pistol, and you know what? I haven't shot anybody yet.
Well, you know, there's certainly no doubt that most human beings simply won't get violent like that. And most kids who watch video games are going to grow up to be kind and loving people, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there's any doubt that for some people, this kind of hypnotic, hours-long involvement in violent activities, it just cannot be good for the soul, and it certainly can train you.
I agree. Now, is there a window, though, where a kid is more vulnerable? I mean, if they're doing in video games, let's say from 10 to 15, is that more impressionable than if they do it when they're 25?
Well, I think that with most things, it's going to be the earlier that this becomes a part of life, the more it's going to be hard, I think, for the child to have a balance about it. And I think it's up to parents, like the parent who just called in, to be the judge of how the games are affecting her child. Certainly, these games are fabulous for problem solving. They're fabulous for motivation. They just they must be doing just all kinds of things to make people quicker and faster neurologically than my generation. But does it have to be a violent game? Does it have to be a violent game to give that that motivation to do all of that really great problem solving?
Let's go to Lima, Ohio. John is with us east of the Rockies. John, go ahead.
Hi, Doctor. Hi, George.
Hey, John.
If I could get a little personal, just a moment. Due to some pre-birth complications, when I was a kid especially, the size of my head was slightly larger than I guess you would say the average student.
Okay.
And around the holidays, they would take us into the gym and show us movies. And which, by the way, I've got one of the movies that I play this day to, for my wife and daughter to, you know. But, you know, I would listen to the comments of the people behind me.
About you.
About me.
Okay.
And I asked the teachers, I said, could you set me off to the side and toward the back so that I won't be in anybody's way? And no, it wasn't possible. It wasn't doable. I had to be, you know, sat right out in the middle where I could listen to what I heard. And, you know, I was somewhat of a loner in school, but, you know, I did have a few friends, you know, but I never thought about taking a gun to school and
killing everybody.
Yeah, right. Killing anybody. But I guess my question is how can we get some discernment back? You know, there wasn't anything that I was asking that was unreasonable.
Right. Well, first of all, let me say that, you know, the vast majority of people, no matter how abused and humiliated they have been, do not become violent. And many of my patients, the one thing they don't want to do is make any excuses from their childhood. They want to get over it and move on. And they don't want anybody else making excuses.
Well, let me ask you this, Peter, though.
Mm-hmm.
Not all people who are abused become violent. But
right. Can
you say that all violent people have been abused?
They've either been abused or they are on psychiatric or street drugs.
It's one or the other.
In my experience, it's one or the other. The person is either wigged out on a substance that has destroyed their impulse control, their empathy, their social relationships, their caring about other people, or they've had some sort of childhood background which has made them feel very humiliated, very withdrawn, and very, very angry.
Most of the people are younger men, teenagers, or people in their 20s like this one. What's the trigger that finally pushes them over the edge and they do this? My question, why didn't they do it 6 months ago? Why do they do it now? What happens?
Well, for the people on the drugs, it's very clear. It's often just nothing more than a change in the dose.
And it just builds up.
The brain gets jarred, and they freak out over a nothing trigger, just virtually nothing. Often there's a buildup, and a lot of these kids we've seen, and we just don't know this boy's story, there's a buildup of feeling humiliated, and then the planning starts. You feel powerful because you're anticipating the planning and the things you're going to do. You start to feel like you're not the outsider. You're going to be, you know, the one who makes his mark, and that builds up over time. I don't think it's often a single trigger in that context of these kids who finally break. I think it's a buildup. But with the people on the drugs who get so injured from the drugs, it can be virtually no provocation.
Next up, we go to Houston, Texas. Chuck's with us. Chuck, thank you. Go ahead.
Hello, Dr. Bregan, do you think it's likely that the perpetrators in these mass shootings are poor metabolizers, those that have the polymorphism of the gene that causes poor metabolizing of the antidepressants? Eli Lilly's own internal data show that 14% of antidepressant users of vulnerable subpopulation are at greater risk of adverse reactions. And do you think we should be taking a look at this? That's probably 2 to 3 million people that may be walking time bombs out there amongst us.
There's actually a growing body of research that's indicating that the people who do perpetrate, many of, not all, but many of the people who perpetrate violence on psychiatric drugs, in particular the antidepressants, are lacking the enzyme that clears that drug out of the system, so you get an abnormal height of the drug. Basically, instead of getting 50 milligrams, you're getting 150. So that increase in dose, unexpected, unplanned for, is pushing some people over. There's some publications about this now. So there's no doubt about it. But see, the drug companies don't want to develop very simple tests that could be made inexpensive to test people for these enzymes before they're giving the meds, because they don't want to deal with this issue. So you'd have to go to a lab where often it costs a fair amount of money. You'd have to find it. The doctor would have to know about it. But the point you bring up is very good. And the simple way it works is that if the liver can't break down the drug as well, because of a genetic difference in enzymes, you're going to get overdoses of the drug. That always makes more likely any kind of bad effect.
Peter, it's a tragedy beyond anything I can imagine. And unfortunately, is going to happen again, isn't it?
Yes, and we have now the likelihood that it will happen sooner rather than later. People need to be alert. Many of these kids do signal. So for those of you who are working in the schools, be aware that often there's some sort of signaling. There's a drawing made or a story written or something said to a friend or an abrupt change in behavior. So be on the alert for that. And we've got to start to just really work on our schools continuing to be more loving, more caring places. Even in that relatively good school system, apparently, in Newtown, Connecticut, this young man apparently just went right along like a ghost through the school. We just need to keep building our social relationships.
Up next, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM, we're going to have open lines for you. Thank you, Peter. Appreciate you being on the program, giving us this kind of feedback to this tragedy. Okay, now, 2 hours of open lines next. We'll be back.